Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 687, update on September 11th and related topics. This is being recorded on August 30th of the year 2009. There is so much going on that we're just going to plunge right in. As always, SpitfireList.com, the best website for this type of material on earth. Sadly, I wish there were others. Please use it, and if you only listen to the For the Record broadcasts, increasingly you are missing out, because increasingly there is information in the written descriptions for the program that I did not have time to include in the original broadcast. So please use the website. Well, we're going to start right off with an article from the New York Times of May 30th of 2009, an Eric Lichtblau story. It's headlined, Justice Department Backs Saudi Royal Family on 9/11 Lawsuit. It reads in part, the Obama administration is supporting efforts by the Saudi royal family to defeat a long-running lawsuit seeking to hold it liable for the September 11, 2001 attacks. The Justice Department, in a brief filed Friday before the Supreme Court, said it did not believe the Saudis could be sued in American court over accusations brought by families of the September 11 victims that the royal family had helped finance al-Qaeda. The department said it saw no need for the court to review lower court rulings that found in the Saudis' favor in throwing out the lawsuit. The government's position came less than a week before President Obama is scheduled to meet in Saudi Arabia with King Abdullah as part of a trip to the Middle East and Europe intended to reach out to the Muslim world. Lawyers for the Saudi family said that they were heartened by the department's brief and that it served to strengthen their hand before the court, which has not decided whether to hear the case. But family members of several September 11th victims said they were deeply disappointed and questioned whether a decision was made to appease an important ally in the Middle East. The Saudis have aggressively lobbied both the Bush and Obama administrations to have the lawsuit dismissed, government officials say. And skipping down, Solicitor General Elena Kagan said in the brief before the Supreme Court that her office agreed with the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit that, quote, the princes are immune from petitioners' claims, unquote, although she pointed to somewhat different legal rationales in reaching that conclusion. Ms. Kagan noted that the Supreme Court had historically looked to the executive branch to take the lead on such international matters because of, quote, the potentially significant foreign relations consequences of subjecting another sovereign state to suit, unquote. So note that basically it is the executive branch that's doing this, and this should come as no surprise whatsoever, because basically, to make a very long story very short, the U.S. is bankrupt, and the Saudis in many ways have got this country right by the short hairs from an economic standpoint. Not only do they hold a lot of our T-bills, but the Saudis are deeply invested in many American corporations, the petroleum connection only being one of those. The Saudis have been heavily invested in many corporations, including and especially the media. They're deeply invested in the universities, and along with some of the other Middle Eastern oil-producing kingdoms, they really exert a profound influence in corporate America. And indeed, the Saudi royal family is so close to the Bush administration that one member of the Saudi royal family, Prince Bandar, was referred to as Bandar Bush. And the links between the Saudi elite and the BCCI milieu, the milieu busted in the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids, and the milieu that perpetrated the September 11th attacks could not be exaggerated. And among the many reasons for this, if you start pursuing the terror financing money trail, it is inextricably linked with the GOP, the Bush administration, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, and company, something I've spoken about at great length. One of the people who was deeply implicated in financing al-Qaeda, an individual who used libel tourism, as it's called, basically filing nuisance lawsuits in the United Kingdom, which has very different libel laws, in order to silence critics, well, fortunately, one of them just bit the farm. Whether this was actually a natural heart attack or whether somebody finally decided to do the human race a favor and kill Khalid bin Mahfouz is an academic point under the circumstances. But finally, Khalid bin the human race and the earth have been relieved of the presence of Khalid bin Mahfouz. The New York Times of August 28th of 2009 has the following story, which reads in part, its headline, Khalid bin Mahfouz, Saudi banker, dies at 60. Some accounts put this at 59. It reads in part, Khalid bin Mahfouz, a billionaire Saudi banker who paid $225 million to settle charges of bank fraud in 1993 and later won a string of lawsuits in Britain against writers who had accused him of supporting terrorism, died Sunday at his home in Jeddah. He was 60 and the cause was a heart attack, according to reports in the Arab news media. In many ways, Sheikh Mahfouz typified Saudi Arabia's super wealthy. He maintained opulent homes around the world and traveled in his own Boeing 767 with gold-plated bathroom fixtures, the New York Times' Douglas Martin writes. Last year, the magazine Arabian Business ranked him 24th in its list of the 50 richest Arabs with a fortune estimated at $3.35 billion. Bin Mahfouz rose to prominence through his 30% ownership in the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI, which was shut down in 1991 after charges of financial chicanery and money laundering. Sheikh Mahfouz paid $225 million to settle fraud charges by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the Federal Reserve. District Attorney Robert M. Morgenthau said $37 million of the settlement was a fine. But Sheikh Mahfouz denied that any of the settlement was a fine, pointing out that he had not acknowledged any wrongdoing. He said he had agreed to the settlement, quote, purely as a business decision, unquote. After the September 2001 terrorist attacks, considerable suspicion fell on Saudi financiers and charities as sources of financing for terrorism. Partly because so much money passed through his bank and a charity he helped establish, Sheikh Mahfouz faced a barrage of accusations in books, newspapers, and magazines that he and his family had funneled money to Al-Qaeda. He vehemently denied that and repeatedly and often successfully pressed publications for corrections. He also took advantage of Britain's pro-plaintiff libel laws to sue publishers, almost all of whom settled before trial. Well, the evidence that the late Khalid bin Mahfouz was involved in financing terrorism and Al-Qaeda and other Muslim Brotherhood offshoots in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood being an Islamic fascist organization, as I've said so many times, the evidence is very, very strong. But problem is, folks, that civil court, U.S. or Britain, often has more to do with money than justice and truth. And Khalid bin Mahfouz had a hell of a lot more money than the people who were going after him. And so he was basically able to just beat him into the ground using that money, using high-priced lawyers, and, as indicated there, filing suit in Britain, engaging in what is known as libel tourism. Britain's libel laws are very different from ours, and we're going to go into that in just a second. Go to the SpitfireList.com website. There is abundant evidence. Do a search on bin Mahfouz, last name Mahfouz, and you'll see abundant information indicating his role in financing terrorism. But, of course, truth is a commodity to be purchased, and when you have billions of dollars at your disposal, you can hire some nasty lawyers, and when you want to put those lawyers to work in Britain, well, just regular old journalists don't have much of a chance. However, American journalists are going to have a better chance because a bill has passed which outlaws libel tourism in the United States. The San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, May 15th, of 2009 had an article about this. Article by Bob Ajelko headlined, Overwhelming Support for Libel Tourism Bill. Legislation designed to thwart libel tourism, the practice of trying to silence one's critics by suing them in England where defamation is easier to prove than in the United States, cleared the Senate without a dissenting vote on Thursday. The bill, prompted by the case of a Saudi businessman who sued a U.S. author in a British court for accusing him of financing terrorists, would prohibit enforcement of most foreign libel verdicts in California. The Senate's 38-0 vote moved the legislation by Senator Ellen Corbett, Democrat of San Leandro, to the Assembly. Britain has become a mecca for mostly rich folks who can litigate there to obtain judgments for bad things people say about them in California or anywhere else, said Thomas Newton, lawyer for the California Newspaper Publishers Association, which is sponsoring the bill. One difference between British and U.S. libel law is that a U.S. plaintiff must prove that the defamatory statement was false. In Britain, once the plaintiff shows that a statement would harm his or her reputation, the defendant must prove it was true. The U.S. Supreme Court has also ruled that a public official or prominent person suing for libel must prove that a falsehood was knowing or reckless, a requirement not imposed in Britain or any other nation. Corbett's bill, SB 320, would allow a California court to enforce a foreign award of damages from libel only if it came from a nation that provided the same protections to defendants that U.S. and California courts have recognized. A similar law was signed last year in New York. Although there has been no organized opposition to Corbett's bill, a lawyer for the Saudi entrepreneur whose suit gave rise to the measures in both California and New York said Thursday that the legislation, quote, addresses a problem that actually doesn't exist, unquote. In fact, no foreign libel judgment has ever been enforced in the United States, said the attorney Timothy Finn. Without such laws, he said, U.S. courts refuse to enforce libel verdicts from nations that don't protect the freedom to speak critically. But even the threat of being sued for libel overseas has a chilling effect on free speech, said Rachel Ehrenfeld, the New York writer who was sued by Finn's client. I'm an American citizen. I felt I had very good protection from the First Amendment, Ehrenfeld said. She learned otherwise after publishing her 2003 book, Funding Evil, which documented the alleged role of Saudi billionaire Khalid bin Mahfouz in financing terrorism. Bin Mahfouz, who has filed numerous suits disputing similar allegations, sued Ehrenfeld in England, where he owns property and where 23 copies of her book were sold online. 23 copies. Wow. Poor guy, must have really shook him up. Continuing, unwilling to hire a British lawyer and defend herself, she defaulted. Bin Mahfouz was awarded $15,000 in damages plus $210,000 in legal fees and court costs. You know, that wouldn't have even paid for the toilet paper in the bathroom of his Boeing 67 with the gold fixtures. Continuing, although Ehrenfeld hasn't had to pay any damages, she said the verdict has made her reluctant to travel overseas and has hurt her research. Well, good for California, which has really, really good slap suit and now libel verdict legislation. Makes this a good place to do investigative reporting. And as far as the late, not-so-great Khalid bin Mahfouz, good riddance to bad rubbish. And again, check out the Spitfire List website. There is abundant evidence that, in fact, his disclaimers to the contrary and his billions of dollars in legal saber-rattling notwithstanding, that he was doing just that. But, of course, the Saudi elite, since they own the United States, the Obama administration is following suit following in the footsteps of the Bush administration. By the way, there was an interesting detail. I'm going to double-check this the next time we visit with John Loftus. There's a defense and intelligence newsletter out of Israel called the Debka Net Weekly, which has some good information and some bad information. Again, it has to be critically evaluated. But it alleged that the Obama administration had sent a couple of missions to Saudi Arabia to ask for Saudi help in helping to bail out the now crashed, bankrupt U.S. economy. And basically, the Saudis told them to go piss up a rope unless they ceased their diplomatic outreach to Iran and their Shia rivals. I don't know if that's true, but it does indicate the extent to which American policy is hostage to such considerations. We've alluded to terror funding, and I also made a reference to John Loftus. It was his pursuit of Sami Al-Arian, the Bush associate and Muslim Brotherhood member who was the head of North America's branch of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that led to the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. Those raids uncovered profound links between the Republican Party, the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, and the institutions and individuals who were implicated in the financing of terrorism, including Al-Qaeda. There's been a ruling in connection with that. The following is from the Washington Post of May 7th, 2009. Court upholds searches of Muslim groups in Virginia. It's by Jerry Marcon, and it reads in part, an appeals court yesterday upheld the legality of federal raids on a Herndon, Virginia-based network of Muslim charities, businesses, and think tanks, a cause that caused a firestorm in the Muslim community. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit said the March 2002 raids on homes and businesses in Herndon and elsewhere in Northern Virginia were, quote, a harrowing experience, unquote, for the targets, but did not violate their constitutional rights. The court said agents exercised, quote, lawful force, unquote, in drawing their guns and handcuffing a family whose home was searched. Federal agents carted away hundreds of boxes of documents during the searches from some of the most established Islamic organizations in the United States. They were looking for evidence of an international network to finance terrorism, part of what federal officials have called the nation's largest terrorism financing investigation. Muslim leaders denounced the raids as violation of their civil rights and have strongly denied terrorist ties. A Herndon family sued federal agents involved in the raids, asserting that the agents had fabricated evidence to obtain a search warrant, falsely imprisoned family members by restraining them in their home, and violated their civil rights. A federal judge in Alexandria dismissed the lawsuit in 2007, and a three-judge Fourth Circuit panel upheld that dismissal yesterday. Peter Carr, a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alexandria, said prosecutors are pleased with the ruling. An attorney for Iqbal and Aisha Unus, who filed the lawsuit along with their teenage daughter, declined to comment. The raids have led to several indictments and the conviction of prominent Muslim activist Abdurrahman al-Amoudi, who admitted that he plotted with Libya to assassinate the ruler of Saudi Arabia. No charges have been filed against the Herndon-based cluster of companies and charities that are at the center of the investigation, and their attorneys and some Muslims have long labeled the raids a fishing expedition. Samuel Arian, a former Florida professor who earlier pleaded guilty to aiding a terror organization, is now charged with refusing to testify before a federal grand jury in the Herndon probe. A federal judge has not ruled on a defense motion to dismiss those charges. Well, as I noted in For the Record 6-34, basically Sammy the Aryan, as I call him, a close ally of George Bush, rather like the individuals and institutions that got busted in these raids, Sammy the Aryan basically has refused to testify against the International Institute for Islamic Thought because basically he fears violent retribution. Well, if there's nothing there, if there's nothing untoward, what's he afraid of? I mean, if it's just a wonderful little religious and philosophical organization, why should he be so afraid of retribution? Largely a rhetorical question, speaks for itself. But again, note that among the many things that the mainstream press should just hang their heads in shame over is their failure to address this, and also the so-called progressive sector, which even unlike the mainstream press, which have just covered this up, they've actually extolled Sammy the Aryan as something of a martyr. And then, of course, we've got the controlled demolition freaks, basically accessories after the fact in September 11th. But you'll never convince them of that. One of the most interesting aspects of the investigation into September 11th, and one of the most important elements of that, is the uncovering of profound evidentiary tributaries between many of the terrorist incidents of the late 80s, 90s, and the early part of this decade, which were supposedly separate incidents, but which actually have evidentiary tributaries connecting them. Some of those involve the bombing of Pan Am 103 in 1988. One of the principal people implicated in that is Manzar El-Kassar. Manzar El-Kassar's name crops up in the connection with a number of different terrorist incidents, including the AMIA bombing in Argentina in 1994. There are evidentiary tributaries connecting the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center with the Oklahoma City bombing, and in turn linking the Oklahoma City bombing and the 1993 World Trade Center attack to September 11th. And there are a number of tributaries linking the 1994 AMIA bombing to all of these things. Not only is Manzar El-Kassar implicated in this, but when FBI investigators began looking into the 1994 bombing of the center and the AMIA bombing of a Jewish cultural center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, they came across an interesting fact. The Argentine security officials who were implicated in that attack were members of White Aryan Resistance, an American white supremacist organization headed up by Tom Metzger. By the way, Tom Metzger recently interviewed none other than Boyd Rice, a popular industrial musician who is an overt self-proclaimed fascist and very close to the Feral House publishing milieu, which specializes in conspiracy research and also has doctrinaire links to satanic elements and the Manson family and other overt so-called counterculture fascist elements. Very interesting to see White Aryan Resistance connected to Argentine security officials perpetrating a terror incident on behalf of Iran and Hezbollah. Recently, as discussed in these broadcasts, an investigator in Argentina was kidnapped by some of those same security officials and was tortured at some length or threatened with torture if he didn't back off. By the way, Timothy McVeigh was also allegedly a member of White Aryan Resistance. Again, there are the the official versions of those various attacks, ranging from Pan Am 103, the 1993 World Trade Center attack, the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, the 1994 AMIA bombing, and the September 11th, 2001 attacks are very different than what we have been told, and the evidentiary tributaries connecting all of those are most significant and highlight the existence of what I call the Underground Reich. Literally, a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like style, its primary element of power being the consummate economic clout that is available to it. Also profound political connections to the mainstream political establishments of, among other countries, the United States and Germany. Very recently, Mr. Ahmadinejad of Iran appointed a man who has been charged by Interpol and is wanted by Interpol for the AMIA bombing as Iran's defense minister. Yet another New York Times story, this one from August 22nd of 2009 by Michael Slackman, is headlined, Ahmadinejad nominee is wanted in 94 bombing. The man nominated to serve as Iran's defense minister is wanted by Interpol in connection with the 1994 bombing of a Jewish cultural center in Buenos Aires, confronting Iran with yet another challenge to its international reputation after an electoral dispute undermined its legitimacy at home and abroad. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad nominated Vahmad Vahidi on Wednesday to serve as defense minister when he submitted his list of 21 nominees to the Iranian parliament. Mr. Vahidi was the head of the secret Quds Force, an arm of the Revolutionary Guards that carries out operations overseas. He was one of five Iranian officials sought by Interpol on Argentine charges of, quote, conceiving, planning, financing, and executing, unquote, the 1994 attack which killed 85 people and wounded hundreds, said a statement issued by the Anti-Defamation League condemning the nomination. The hand of Tehran was suspected early in the investigation. However, some criminal justice experts have raised questions recently about Iran's having had a direct role in the attack, saying it was more likely the work of an Iranian proxy group, Hezbollah, and others in South America. Well, again, they say a picture's worth a thousand words. For those people who are wondering, you know, what, and again, I can appreciate that the various investigative hypotheses presented here will certainly seem complicated if completely unintelligible to newer listeners. Again, use the website. That'll help you out a lot. But if you're wondering how you get Argentine fascists, members of an American white supremacist group, collaborating with the Iranian allied or Iranian elements to perpetrate a bombing against a Jewish cultural center in Argentina, go to a photo essay about Hezbollah by Time magazine. It's called Inside, and Hezbollah is spelled as follows, H I, Z as in zebra, B A L L A H. Again, Inside, H I Z B A L L A H. Look at what you see, and that'll explain it, okay? Very scary article, this one from Reuters, datelined August 28th of 2009, article by Mark Heinrich. IAEA extends probe of alleged Syria atoms site, it reads. UN inspectors are analyzing further evidence taken from a nuclear research plant in Syria's capital Damascus, where unexplained uranium traces were found, the UN's nuclear watchdog said on Friday. But the International Atomic Energy Agency said Syria was still blocking follow-up access to the desert site of what U.S. intelligence reports said was a nascent North Korea-designed nuclear reactor meant to yield atomic bomb fuel before Israel bombed it to pieces in 2007. In June, the Vienna-based IAEA said particles of processed uranium showed up in swipe samples taken by inspectors at the research reactor in Damascus, and that it was checking for a link to traces retrieved from the bombed Deir al-Zour site. The IAEA said on Friday it carried out an inventory verification check at the Damascus Miniature Neutron Source Reactor, or MNSR, in July, collecting environmental samples of what Syria said was the source of the uranium particles. The samples were now being analyzed, with the results likely to be ready by November. U.S. analysts have said that IAEA's findings raise the question of whether Syria used some natural uranium intended for the alleged reactor at Deir al-Zour for experiments applicable to learning how to separate plutonium from spent nuclear fuel. Syria's only declared nuclear site is the Damascus Research Reactor, and unlike Iran, it has no known nuclear energy generating capability. Syria has said that the uranium traces at Deir al-Zour came with Israeli munitions used in that strike and that Israel's target was a conventional military building. Damascus denies hiding anything from the IAEA, but the agency says Syria is withholding documentation and blocking access that inspectors need to clarify the case. Syria, an ally of Iran which is under IAEA investigation over nuclear proliferation suspicions, has denied ever having an atomic bomb program and said the intelligence is fabricated. Damascus has complained that its case is being mishandled and questioned the IAEA's grasp of physics. But the IAEA said earlier this year that inspectors had found enough traces of uranium in soil samples collected in June 2008 at Deir al-Zour to constitute a significant, unquote, find. They subsequently detected similar man-made uranium particles in test swipes at the Damascus research site, which the IAEA knew about and checked routinely. Friday's report said Syria, citing national security grounds, was still refusing IAEA requests for return visits to Deir al-Zour and a look at three military sites whose appearance was altered by landscaping after the IAEA asked to check them. I wonder why they did that. Probably nothing, you know, just a little landscaping. Wanted to get a few more date palms in there, provide a little more shade for travelers. Sure, it's perfectly innocent. By the way, the aforementioned Don Loftus, with whom we'll be visiting again in the not-too-distant future, maintained that in the ultimate sort of comedy of errors, that the nascent WMD technology, not that Saddam Hussein actually had active WMDs, but that with some of that technology and know-how, the tool technology and know-how was transferred to Syria, and that may very well have been combined, I should say, with the North Korean technology to produce that facility. So not only did the Bush administration blow it by linking Iraq falsely with September 11th, and also lying about Iraq having active WMD programs, their nation technology stored in a huge underground vault under a river was transferred right out. By the way, there was military scuttlebutt to that effect after the invasion. So that's blowing it about five times over. The Bush administration did indeed wreck the train. With nukes spreading around the Middle East, Pakistan's already got it. They're one of our, quote, allies in terrorism. Now we're going to be giving, quote, peaceful, unquote, nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. Iran is working on it. Syria's working on it. Get ready for some football, folks. You know, sooner or later, there's going to be the mushroom cloud which George Bush falsely linked to Saddam Hussein to justify the Iraq war. That's going to happen. You ready for some football? You want a little nuclear war? Stay tuned. A very disheartening bit of commentary was voiced on Fox News. This is by Michael Scheuer, who formerly headed up the CIA's task force into bin Laden. A website at largely.com talked about this, and Mr. Scheuer said, quote, on Fox News, that reliable institution, who's, by the way, News Corp's second largest stockholder, is Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mr. Scheuer said, quote, the only chance we have as a country right now is for Osama bin Laden to deploy and detonate a major weapon in the United States. Only Osama can execute an attack which can force Americans to demand that their government protect them effectively, consistently, and with as much violence as necessary, unquote. I'm sorry to say that I think it's only too possible that resentful national security officials in this country could overlook such an incident. So, again, get ready for some football, folks. Have fun. That concludes For the Record program number 687, update on September 11th and related matters. This program has been recorded on August 30th of the year 2009. Please use the website. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.